I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
Now, let's listen.
This is the America's Hat podcast, a Canadian take on American politics. I'm Leanna Kersner, and where do I begin? Between Trump's very Trumpy State of the Union, the mess in the Democratic Iowa caucuses, Bernie Bros claiming that the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, managed a grand conspiracy with the DNC to mess up the Iowa caucuses, Trump's impeachment hearings managing to make Ken Starr look sleazier, and Alan Dershowitz managed to argue that the president is more powerful than a king, this all begs the question, what the heck is going on in America? So, here to decipher this, at least begin to decipher this very confusing question is Gregory Simpson, who works in the educational field and is a business journalist, and David Slavik, who is an American political consultant living in Toronto, who's worked in Democratic politics for almost two decades and spent years in Washington, D.C. think tanks and grassroots lobbying. Gentlemen, welcome. This hopefully will be a very Canadian conversation, meaning very polite and hopefully rational. Welcome to America's Hat.
Hey, Leon, how are you?
Hey, okay.
Hey, thanks for having me. They sent me up here because I was too polite to stay in the United States.
Okay, David, you took a crack, so I'm going to open up with you. As somebody who's worked in Democratic politics and has been in Washington, D.C. think tanks, do you have any grasp of what strategy was behind that State of the Union? Because to me, it just seemed like a YouTube playlist of Trump greatest hits. Like, there was no overarching narrative. There was no sort of story to tell. It was just sort of emotional beat. Am I missing something?
I think that actually you're not missing anything. I think you're onto it. And I think that is the strategy.
Okay.
The Trumpian strategy has never been about a coherent narrative. It has been about emotional impulses that reach into sort of the gut of people and touch upon the things that scare and the things that make people angry. And I think that Trump hit those points in ways that transcended some of his earlier work. I'm not speaking positively of Donald Trump. In fact, I think he's a disaster. I'm a lifelong Democrat, someone who believes in human rights, someone who cares about rights towards women, cares about immigrants, cares about, you know, the general welfare of the country. But he hit his points very well because he kept to the hits. And Donald Trump is, he's like when you go see Journey, they're going to play all the best songs. They're not going to play the new stuff. And I think that that's what he does well. And I think that's what he did best last night.
So he's just going back to the well because it's worked for him so far, basically?
Yeah, I think it's a Pavlovian type of politics where, you know, he knows how to ring the dinner bell and the dogs come running.
Right.
He is in an electoral year where he doesn't know exactly what candidate he'll face. Mm-hmm. He is in a situation where he was on the brink of being impeached. I mean, he was impeached by the House, but he was not prosecuted by the Senate. So it really is a situation where he has to make sure that he has that groundswell ready. His attack on the right to choose was much harsher, I think, in this instance than it had been in the past. And I think his use of sort of human shields, the guests in the crowd, was also much more effective than he had been in the past. Trump isn't a genius, but he is a master of show.
It's interesting you bring up those two points. Let's stick a pin in that and come back to it because they're very important. Greg, I want to ask you, since you're in education, if you were in a classroom and students behaved the way people in the U.S. government did during the State of the Union, how would you handle it? The fact that, you know, Trump does something as petty as refusing to shake somebody's hand deliberately. Like many, many observers said, it was a direct sort of bullying of Nancy Pelosi to give Rush Limbaugh the Medal of Freedom. How do you teach teenagers that this stuff is not cool when you're seeing leaders do it to the point that, you know, Nancy Pelosi was ripping up the speech right then and there? Trump clearly got under her skin. Even she sort of broke down and didn't behave well. How do you educate in this environment?
Well, I think the important part you hit on is that we're looking at these grown people, these adults who are in very large seats of power, and they're acting like children. They're acting like barking seals. And what really highlighted kind of the mess that they're in down there is the fact that you only have to see a few clips of the speech to see the obvious signs of dementia creeping in with Trump. I mean, I think at one point he said sanctuary cities or something. And you can see it. You can see in the way his words are dissembling, and that he's unable to really string together coherent thought other than kind of, like you said, playing the hits.
Now, we're in a part where some people say we can't be sure Trump has dementia because he's always been like this. But I did notice a similar thing. I noticed some of the not famous guests, he grasped on their first name, and it seemed like he'd forgotten their surname, which is odd because it should be right on the teleprompter. But there were moments he did sort of seem to lose it when he wasn't doing that high emotional impact, when he wasn't sort of obsessed with the fear tactics. He did seem lost.
Yeah, and I've seen a couple ads. I'm not sure if they were Bloomberg or Daily Show or something to that effect, but or maybe even Bill Maher, and they strung together just all the clips of when he has, like I said, not just stumbled over a word or forgot something. I mean, we're all guilty of that, but you can see it in his body language. You can hear it in his voice, like the actual slurring and the dissembling. And, you know, what's become more and more apparent, I believe, is that, you know, Trump is more and more becoming a sick old man, and he's being propped up by a very dangerous organization, what Noam Chomsky actually called the most dangerous organization in the history of human beings, which is the GOP. You know, it's interesting that if you look at what the Senate has been doing tonight, they took their impeachment vote. That was all done and tied up in a neat little bow. And then immediately after, Mitch McConnell filed the paperwork on a dozen judges, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the agenda that the GOP has carried out while everyone's really busy paying attention to the latest outrageous thing Trump says, is they have remade American judiciary in their image and the way they want it. So as far as they're concerned, they're more than happy to let this aging carnival barker continue to take the spotlight. They know that Mike Pence was just as wrapped up in all this as anybody. Mm-hmm. They went around to all their people and said, do you want President Pelosi? Is that what you want? No, I don't think it's what you want.
So you think they sort of stuck a cork in it because they knew if they let the roller coaster run, it wouldn't stop?
I don't see any way it's any different. I mean, so much focus is on how you know, people think they are kowtowing to Trump or they are scared of Trump. But these are power-hungry people. Mm-hmm. These are people who have held positions of power far longer than Trump's been there and theoretically could be there long after he left. So I think it's naive to think that this is all it's a fear-based mechanism for them. I think it's a self-serving mechanism. They have an agenda to carry out, and this is how they're doing it. And he has given them absolutely everything they wanted. The U.S. embassy has been moved to Jerusalem. You know, the list of countries that have been banned now is a white nationalist dream. I think half of the African population or a quarter of the African population can't even enter the United States anymore.
Like, yeah, I admit when he did that shout out to the Tuskegee Airmen, I was that triggered me. That managed to get under my skin. I'm like, oh, wow, you know, you're honoring guys who serve their country in the Jim Crow era. Well, and I know this is about this is hyperbole. Like I said, it's an emotional response. Well, you're trying to bring it back.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
You know, that's really interesting that you say that, because it, you know, that juxtaposition between the Tuskegee Airmen and the immigration issue. The interesting thing that Donald Trump has done, and I say interesting not because I'm interested in it, I want to clarify again, but he has really attempted to drive a wedge between what people call ADOs, and that's American descendants of African slavery, mm-hmm. you know, and that would be what we would call an African-American in the typical sense, someone who would call themselves Black, typically. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And those who are from newer immigrants, whether from the Caribbean or from Africa. And, you know, there are some, you know, internal antipathies that people have within those communities because of different situations and different, you know, structural issues that have affected each of the populations. Mm-hmm. And he's really attempted to reach out and sort of stoke those fires, both through the media that he's fostered, through the Republican Party, and through his Mercer-backed, you know, Steve Bannon, Breitbart type of operation, you know, where he's attempted to say, you know, I'm all for, you know, African-Americans, just, you know,
as long as they know their place.
Yes, exactly.
Even then, I mean, this is one of these things. This is one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast, is many Canadians do not understand those tensions between descendants of American slaves and immigrant Black people. Most of the people that we interact with in Canada are, you know, either Canadians from long, long ago, or they're immigrants, right? They're Somali immigrants, or they're from the Caribbean. And I have a few friends who went down to the U.S. to work and got a real culture shock, because what it is to be Black is distinctly different between Canada and the U.S. David, I wonder if you can give us a bit of perspective so that people sort of understand some of the, I don't even know if you could call them dog whistles anymore. They're really overt now.
So the things that I've noticed that were most dramatically changed in recent years was largely through the changing of how police operate in the United States. Mm-hmm. And much of the protect and serve mentality is now turned into what they would call a warfighter mentality.
Yeah, the militarization of the police.
Absolutely. Right. And you're seeing police view themselves as veterans. In the United States, being a garbage collector or, you know, a disposal person is 10 times more dangerous than being a police officer. Yet the police officers have flags on their walls that insist that they're the most endangered people in the world. You know, the rate of shooting of young Black males by police is increasing, despite the fact that we have things like cameras on body cameras and you know, cell phone cameras everywhere. Mm-hmm. So there is something that's going on that's allowing for violence against Black people to occur in a more overt way that we haven't seen since the Jim Crow era. And when that becomes institutionalized in the state, then it trickles down into other people, where they think that they can do things to people and say things to people that they normally wouldn't have.
That's a very interesting way of putting it, because I've heard numerous theories to explain sort of the ongoing racial tensions in the U.S. that Trump is very much exploiting. This is something that drives me crazy about what he does, because it's a very, very hard thing to explain to people unless you sort of get it. This is one of the most sort of visceral, emotional reactions dividing America today. And it's very hard to put into words. Now, I think you just sort of nailed it, that the America is a collection of myths that some of them are varying degrees of true. But one of the myths in America is that everyone can make it. Everybody has a quality of opportunity. And yet, you know, people are still giving their, you know, Black boys the talk about interactions with law enforcement. And that happens to an extent up here, but not, it's not as divided as it is in the U.S. David, when you came up here, did you notice a difference?
I think that, you know, and I'm not going to speak ill of my new country that I love very much. Right. And I'm very happy to be here. I think that I actually thought that the degree was greater, that, you know, from on first glance, it seemed like a much more pleasant place. It is a much more pleasant place for people.
Right.
But there is still systematic problems that, you know, if you talk to your friends, they'll tell you. But in the United States, I think that the open season on Black men
yes.
is unfathomable in many ways. And it, you'll often have conversations with friends or relatives or, you know, people that you know at work, and they'll tell you things about why they have to plan an extra 20 minutes into their commute just in case, or, you know, why they don't take certain roads, or, you know, those types of things. So that is a huge issue.
Yeah. I encountered that in Chicago for the first time. There are certain places you don't go after dark. It just shocked me that there's certain roads you just don't go for various reasons. Sorry, Greg, what?
No, I was just saying, you hear anecdotes of friends going through Detroit with the same thing. And I know people who are white who've taken a wrong turn in Detroit and then get pulled over by the police. The police say, "What are you doing in this neighborhood?" And they say, "Just driving. I don't know. We're just here."
Yeah, LA's gotten better, but there used to be three or four exchanges on the freeway that you just didn't get off.
Yeah, police literally will escort you and go, "No, come on."
Yeah, which is mind-boggling to Canadians. And I want to touch on this. This is not a diversion, listeners, I swear, because this is the context to when Trump brings up a Tuskegee, 100-year-old Tuskegee Airman, as a prop. There are some people who go, "That is offensive to me." And other people go, "Why, you racist?" And it becomes this really, really excellent trap. And
it's gaslighting, right? It's what if you've ever read about what a narcissist does in a relationship, well they'll throw something out there that is quite obviously something that will get you going, and then stand back like, "What, why are you getting going?"
Right? Well, that's exactly what they're doing to Nancy Pelosi right now. Is he got under her skin successfully, and they're saying, "Oh, she tore up the script of the speech that honored a Tuskegee Airman, et cetera, talked about black unemployment. She must be racist." So, Greg, you are saying that is gaslighting.
Well, 100%, because any reasonable person knows that Nancy Pelosi is not a racist.
Right.
And that same reasonable person can, if they have eyes and ears, have known that the Trump administration has pushed policies that are not favorable to anybody but old white men, essentially. So of course it's gaslighting, because it is sheerly designed to make people want to pull their hair out, and then they can turn around and go, "See, you're the crazy one. See, Nancy, you're the one who's off kilter."
Greg, there's one thing that was sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to say that they actually claimed that it was violence. In the White House, actually put out
tearing paper.
Yes, that it was actually tearing up the people who were mentioned in the speech. And I want you to continue, but I wanted to just say that it was even worse than just saying racism, or absolutely. You know,
they pointed out that, or they tried to make the point that it was a government record, and hence it was destroying government record, which carries a 3-year prison term.
Oh Lord.
So I mean, and again, an hour after the impeachment vote, Trump's sharing his old favorite video there of the time covers, where it's Trump 2020, Trump 24, is such on and so forth to 40, 50, you know, that they say, "Oh, he's just trolling liberals." Or is he? Or is he floating that "I'm never leaving" balloon? I mean, who's to know?
Sorry, Greg, did you just have a sudden shift in your audio there?
I don't think so.
Oh, speak again.
I don't think so.
Okay, whatever you did there, you're clearer now than you were. Are you on a cell phone?
I'm on my cell phone, yes.
Okay. So it was probably just a bit of a signal fade. Okay. So no worries, we will continue. So David, I want to zero it tactically. This Trump is trolling America. Trump is gaslighting America. This isn't a new thing. This is something that has sort of been perfected over the years, but Trump just has this natural instinct for it. As a strategist, can you put kind of into words what it is, or is it just sort of just the bully's instinct?
I think it's, you know, what they would call a strategy of tension. You know, you have people who are under constant pressure because of the actions that are actually more tangible, not just the, you know, the sort of niceties that Trump is flouting, but, mm-hmm. you know, the actual impacts of the policy. You know, we have kids in cages, we have education cut, we have cuts to Medicaid, we have people being kicked off the rolls of welfare. And that's creating tension for people. And then if you're empathetic and you actually do care about those things, and, you know, I think many liberals often care a little bit more about some of the niceties because they are doing a little better. Mm-hmm. And these things don't necessarily affect them. They may care, you know, I think they do care, but I think some people are, you know, just offended by the rudeness as well.
Right.
But over time, if you're engaged, especially with social media as it is today, you're going to get to a point where your nerves are raw. And I think that's the same for Nancy Pelosi. It's the same for the Democrats. I think that people assumed that there was going to be a lot of tension released from this impeachment. I think a lot of people thought that something was going to happen more than just the impeachment vote. And it gets to a point where you can actually get people to jump off sides, to give a football analogy. And Trump is the king of getting people to overplay their card. And I think that in this instance, I think Trump knew exactly what he was doing in that, to get that done. I think he knew, given Pelosi's the adulation that she received over her epic clackback, if you remember from last year's State of the Union, where she stood and she sort of moved forward and clapped. It was, you know, was it clear to everyone whether that was actually an affront or, you know, she just claps funny or whatever, but, you know, she did get the desired result. So the temptation is there on behalf of the Democrats to be symbolic. You could see it in the white suits, if you remember the abolitionists.
Yes.
Suits. Suffragette suits.
The suffragettes. I admit I'm a feminist. I'm getting a little bit sick of the women in white.
Because you know what? They're, you know, it's interesting because it's important that they have the appearance. I think that that's always important that people know how many people are there and know it's not half.
Sure.
I think that's important. I think it's also important that people, you know, can distinguish themselves in any way they want to. But I think that after 4 years, the gimmick's up.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe everyone wears sweatpants next year. I don't know. But I
kind of dug, I know it's total pandering, but I kind of dug Rashida Tlaib wearing a traditional Palestinian dress to the State of the Union. I thought that was pretty cool. Like, total pandering. I know it's totally deliberate. There's been all this stuff with Ayanna Pressley and hair and all that stuff, but I prefer that to the white suit cliche. You know, when Hillary Clinton did it, she was the first, you know, viable female presidential candidate. I got that. But the constant going back to the white suits, just, it, to me, it's an indication of how stuck we are.
I think you're right. And the other thing I want to say is that, you know, if we're supposed to be the party of normalcy and getting back to normal, we're not supposed to wear white after Labor Day anyway.
Oh, okay. That's getting into tan suit territory. I don't know if this is a little... Remember the days? Sorry, Greg?
I was going to say, I think this is a beautiful segue, though, into what happened in Iowa, right? It's like, you have a Democratic Party that, for all their great ideas and for all their good intentions, are so heavy on symbolism,
yes,
and so bereft of any substance. I mean, Iowa was a disaster, but if you didn't have 20 candidates who nobody could really agree on which one should be at front and center,
right,
it may not look so chaotic. The fact of the matter is everybody wanted Iowa to tell them who the front runner was, because not a darn person knows that answer.
And that was I think that was a good segue. Thank you. Thank you, Greg. Iowa frustrated me for a lot of reasons. Not least of which was the almost instantaneous Bernie bro conspiracy theories that are just a redux of the system is rigged from 2016. And I do Twitch streaming, which is I play video games on live on the internet, and actually had people telling me that Pete Buttigieg conspired with the DNC to rig the primary results. The absurdity of that is these aren't secret ballots, right? These are people showing up and standing in gyms where every captain for every political candidate is right there doing their own head counts. There is the nice thing about caucuses, as ridiculous and chaotic and complicated as they are, is there are eyewitnesses to what the totals were. Mm-hmm. What is the purpose? And I'm gonna go Greg first, then David, because I think the answer is gonna be a little bit different. One from like somebody who's an observer, somebody who's been in it. What is the purpose of creating an utterly absurd, easily disproven conspiracy theory.
Yeah, so I think every campaign looked at the issue and they looked at the situation as it was unfolding, and there's only a few paths kind of laid out in front of you. I think Warren took the best path, gave a really, really kind of good speech about calming everybody down and let's just let this roll out. This is one of the primaries of 50. So relax, right?
Which is what she's good at. I think she's very pragmatic, which unfortunately I think is what's kind of hurting her.
Yeah, and it's a shame because, again, like a shame of presidential campaigns being such a popularity contest is, I'm sorry, if I had a gigantic bureaucracy and I wanted someone to run it, the person with the most coherent and cogent plans would probably be the best person to interview for the job.
One would think. But this is politics.
Right. And then so you have, Buttigieg, obviously his campaign goes nowhere, just going to come out strong and say, based on our numbers, it looks like we won this one. I think it's natural that the Bernie campaign would go that way. There was some funny business, I don't know if it'd go as hard to say it was corrupt last time, but there's fingers on the scales in 2016.
It looked bad. It was bad optics. We can agree on that.
Yeah. And so yeah. I think that lends a path for them, and whether or not they were smart to take that path, I think is open for quite a bit of debate, but it makes sense based on what they had in front of them.
Okay, so David, your turn. As an insider, as somebody who's worked this stuff, what is the benefit of the Bernie bro, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, conspired with the DNC to delay or suppress caucus results?
Okay, so I'll start with the optics problem.
Okay.
I'm going to get to your question next, but I'm going to start with the optics problem. One of the big problems, and I think someone named Sarah Jones, a writer for the New Yorker, wrote a piece on this, and they said the problem with the Democratic Party isn't a conspiracy, it's the grift. And one of the problems with the Democrats in general is that they have sort of a recycling of campaign staffers who then go into the for-profit areas.
Mm-hmm.
And they get hired by campaigns, and there's some cross-pollination that I think that most industries wouldn't find acceptable. So you have, for example, some of the people who are, so like the wife of the person running the app, I mean, the husband of the wife of the person running the app for the caucus results is the spouse of the person doing communications for Buttigieg. It doesn't look good. I think that's part of the issue.
To a lot of people,
it doesn't look good. Because I know my wife and I, we talk about stuff, right? You talk to your partner about stuff. So
this is when it becomes so personal, because when it comes to stuff like this, my first reaction would be, I'm the last person my husband would tell about something like that.
No, that's true. I mean, it's different for everybody, right? And so you have these pictures and you have these types of things. And then you have sort of the stain of the last election.
Right.
And then you have incompetence. And sort of the way things were handled. You have, the contract was handed out to, a connected company, because that's just how it works for Democrats. It's how it works for Republicans.
Yeah.
Republicans tend to be a little more competent about it.
Well, Republicans also don't make a big deal about it. When you ask a Republican about their stuff, they're like, this is just how the sausage is made. This is business.
They'll cut each other's throats but then they'll pay each other off later.
Yeah.
The Democrats don't actually do a good enough job of sharing the wealth, and I think that's part of the problem. So you have a bunch of people it becomes more centered around certain groups of people, because depending on who had power in the party before, the Clintons and the Obama sort of team, and they're not the same team. I can talk about that later some other time. They're not as closely related as you might think. They held the party powder, and they kind of get to roll out into the private sector, and then get to reap the riches. So you have this sort of incestuous sort of environment. The Bernie people are largely outside of that. That given that a lot of them came in from nonprofits or came in from other sort of industries, labor, et cetera. So they already do feel a little outside of it.
Okay.
So I think that you have to look at their perception from that. Additionally, when you get harassed on Twitch, and I think Twitch is a very tough place to be.
I don't like
to go on it at all.
No, I was good. I was just like, you guys, like, it wasn't harassment. I want to be clear. I was like, what?
Yeah.
It just bored me because, okay, I do a critical thinking podcast on this network as well. Do not come to me with that noise. Like, it's so, I think it's, these people have never actually been to a caucus. They don't live in a caucus state. They don't know how it works, right?
And so you have to understand there's a lot of really eager people who have some bad memories of an earlier time that was their sort of the political birth. And, you know, it's like they, you know, like there's many people who say this about birthing. If you have a traumatic birthing, then, you know, you're going to have some sort of tumultuous life. I don't necessarily believe that. I don't know anything about that, to be honest. But I do think that, like, your first experience can influence the way you react. And I think in this instance where you had sort of the incestuous nature plus just a total incompetent rollout. I mean, they've never had a problem rolling out the caucuses before. So you see that sort of correlation and causation and correlation are different, right?
Yeah. I mean, they added a lot of different degrees of difficulty. They wanted to publish a lot more complex data this time around. And quite frankly, as somebody who works in tech, using an app for something like this, it's a terrible idea because, you know, these, it's not like in Canada where Elections Canada staff are paid. They're paid to go to training. They're paid to work. These are volunteers at these caucuses. And so they don't have the roll up period. They don't have the roll out period. I guess what I'm looking for with this is, why doesn't it matter more that this conspiracy is just patently false? I mean, Greg, you seem to understand psychology. Is there some psychological reason, or this is just a purely political thing?
Well, I've heard before that kind of the basis of the people who tend to find conspiracy theories attractive is it almost stems from an anxiety place where, you know, the world as a big random place is scary. And when events can just happen, when bad things can just happen, then that's a very scary notion to kind of accept.
Okay.
But if there's a gigantic cabal out there, if there's an Illuminati or what have you that is pulling the strings, even if they're malicious or just plain evil, at least somebody's in control. At least there's someone pulling the strings that we can get mad at and that we can direct our frustration towards. So I think in this day and age, with so many people and from most of us being so far removed from the levers of power, that it's scary. It's scary to think that our lives are in the hands of strangers and in the hands of potentially a consensus of people we all know are no smarter or dumber than the rest of us.
So you think that the fears over representative democracy are based in the realities of representative democracy?
I don't know if I'd quite put it like that, but I think nowadays we're seeing, again, people much more comfortable going towards a conspiracy theory, more comfortable saying that there is something big and nefarious going on here. And it's, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are very removed from the process. You know, I vote in every election I can vote in, but I can honestly tell you I very rarely felt like my vote actually counted. Mine made the swing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and this is where I was thinking about this earlier. And David, I wonder if you can give some insights to this. This is where I start going, there might be something deeper going on here. These are questions of worldview and identity. And people are just looking for things to make sense. And it really does seem to me like people are looking for saviors as opposed to competent administrators in politics. Have you noticed that, David, that people are looking for Morning in America, the sequel?
I think that the irony here is that both of the people who are now, so I'm looking at the live results now, on the so essentially the state delegates are allocated by a combination of first round votes and then second round votes.
Yeah.
So right now the first round vote total leader is Bernie Sanders with 40.048 and Buttigieg with 35.352.
Yes.
The second round
that shifted radically.
No, wait. No, this is updated a minute ago.
Okay.
42.027 Sanders has, and Buttigieg has 42.823. Mm-hmm. But then in the state delegates, and this is there's a complicated formula which I can explain if you want. But the Buttigieg is at 26.5 and Sanders is at 25.6. So to go back to your earlier point about
Okay, let me check something.
Go ahead. I'm on CNN.com.
Okay, I'm just now. That is because of the reality that more rural areas punch slightly above the more urban concentrated urban centers.
It's when not it comes nefarious.
To delegate out. Yeah. It's Buttigieg's campaign played by the rules of the game better than Sanders did. They beat him on tactics.
Absolutely. But what I wanted to say is that when you go back to the idea, what people, you know, what we said earlier is that, you know, when people feel like their vote doesn't matter, this is such a complicated formula for a normal person. So when you see that, you're like, oh, what's going on? And, you know, I think that that's interesting. But the other interesting thing is what I wanted to say back to your point was that I think both Buttigieg and Sanders have a little bit of that savior mentality. Like, I think Buttigieg is sort of like, you know, the young knight. And Sanders is sort of the old mage. And, you know, they both have...
So we need a rogue and a priest, and now we can play D&D?
Yeah, absolutely. I knew that you're a role-playing fan, so
yeah,
I
this suddenly... Okay, who's the rogue, and who's the cleric in the D&D?
That's a great one, actually.
I'm trying to... Like, who's the healer?
I think that Warren is the cleric.
Warren is,
and I think Yang is the
okay. Yang's the bard. If we put the bard in instead of a straight up thief, it's definitely Yang.
Yeah.
But I mean, see, Cory Booker, if he had a shot, he'd be a perfect cleric.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Absolutely. He you could put a collar on him, and he'd be a very handsome priest.
Well, he's a vegan. You know, he doesn't eat meat. He's all kumbaya. He's all, you know, what is it? The all about healing and all that stuff and love. He'd be perfect. I'm sorry. I just totally, this makes me way more happy thinking about democratic politics, because it is sort of just a hot mess right now.
And it is like that. And I think that, like, that's the, I think just like when you look at D&D characters, I think it's very easy to think, like, I'm always a roguelike character because it's the best, right? And that may be true.
Okay,
we can
be friends now, because I'm the same way. I love my feet. Sorry, Greg, are we losing you with the D&D
talk? No, I am here. I am all good.
Excellent. Okay. Because, yeah, I used to be all into mages, but I don't know, something happened like 10 years ago, and now I'm all about thieves.
And, you know, that's the thing, is that you those things evolve and those things change. And that what you think is the right character for the game you're playing at that time, with the right dungeon master, et cetera, et cetera, and that's going to change. And I think that some of the people who are invested in each of these sort of characters, as we could call them, or candidates, may view that that's a different game. So I think that we all view each other's allegiance to these types of characters as being religious. But in many ways, it may be more strategic than we think.
This is going to be the strangest segue, but it just totally happened. One of the things that really bugged me coming out of the Iowa caucuses was I saw on someone's Twitter feed the D&D 9 alignments charts. And of course, it was obviously an Elizabeth Warren backer who I don't know. It was either a Warren, Sanders, or Steyer supporter, because Warren was lawful good, Steyer was neutral good, Sanders was chaotic good, and then Biden was like true neutral. They put Andrew Yang in chaotic neutral. So the Asian guy is essentially the class that's crazy, and then they put Buttigieg as lawful evil. They put Tulsi Gabbard as chaotic evil. And I forget who the neutral was. It was another moderate. I think Amy Klobuchar was on that the neutral tier as well. But I'm like, why is anybody who's clearly a Democratic supporter calling anybody in that party evil?
So I have a different chart. So this is great. Actually, this is a lot of fun.
There are a few of them flipping around. But why are they calling each other evil?
Well, I think that's the nature of politics. You know, you always look at the near enemy rather than the far enemy. I think on this chart, Elizabeth Warren is lawful good. Yang is neutral good. Bernie's chaotic good. Lawful neutral is Buttigieg. True neutral is Marianne Williamson. Chaotic neutral is Tom Steyer. Lawful evil is Biden. Neutral evil is Kamala Harris. And chaotic evil is Hillary Clinton.
These are Rorschach blots for the psyche of the person who made these things. Like, what?
As politics is in general.
Okay,
I think we have to be fair about that.
Greg,
lefties, not even just Democrats in the States, lefties eat their own, right? Like, we are weird.
Why though?
Because it's every, like,
I think it's because there's a lot of purity tests, right?
Okay.
I think right wingers have a very, I don't know, they seem to glam onto power more than anything. And I think lefties do too, but they seem to have to do it in a way that maintains the veneer of what's the word I'm looking for?
Well, to me, it's all a bunch of white liberals trying to look less racist than other white liberals.
That's not unfair.
That seems okay. I thought I was just being, you know, provocative, because that's what I've noticed lately. Because I am white, I used to think I was liberal. It's weird because every position I have is progressive. Mm-hmm. And yet people keep calling me a moderate. And it's like, why? Because I don't want to set everybody else on fire?
Well, you know, it's interesting because as the American here, and I will say this, is that half of the things that we claim are left in the United States are really just things that you already have here.
Okay. So, you know,
so
it's, okay.
You know, so like even the people who are, you know, sort of the blue Tories in Toronto still are in ways further left than the Democrats.
Well, John Tory would be a Democrat.
Biden would be a conservative in Canada.
Yes, yes, absolutely, he would.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's something that the AOC got in trouble for, but it's just actually a litmus test of like United States sort of like thin bandwidth of politics. So it is interesting to see, because I always laugh when I meet somebody, they're like, well, I'm a conservative. I'm like, well, you still have healthcare.
Yeah.
And so it's always kind of a funny exercise for me when I talk to Canadians.
Okay, David, is this just something we cannot understand, because our conservatives here would basically be a Southern Democrat, not even?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, but let's be honest. I think that the devil is creeping up from the West. And I think that if we're being honest about what's happening in politics, we have rebel media taking an increasing foothold in the country. You know, we have some real bad actors, and some of the worst actors in the States came from Canada.
It's
and
weird
I think
because,
that we have to be honest about that.
Because we're hiring American consultants, but like some of ours are going down there. It's like an exchange program for, like, I don't know, political psyops. And it's not even that deep. Sorry,
and to quote Trump, I would say we're not sending our best.
We're sending Tories. I don't know, Greg. What were you gonna say?
I'm not sure. I lost my train of thought. But
okay. Then David, I'm gonna ask one more thing. Is this partially just American form of communication? Because one of the things I always have to get used to dealing with Americans outside of like certain cities, Vermont, no problem. They're very quiet.
Lovely people.
Very quiet, but they're practically Canadian in their socialization. But you go to some of the bigger cities and it is just loud. It is elbows up. It is competitive. And you would think they were ready to kill each other, and it's just a conversation.
Yeah. I'm from Pennsylvania, which I would say is probably, other than New Jersey, the most aggressive state.
Really?
And yes. You know, I grew up 2 hours from New York City and 2 hours from Philadelphia.
Oh, so you're getting a New York kind of halo effect.
Yeah.
Because getting further north in Pennsylvania, it's pretty chill. It's racist AF.
Yes.
But it's pretty chill.
Absolutely. So you could be on the eastern part of the state, and it's pretty aggressive. And Pittsburgh is a pretty rough and tumble town as well.
Yeah, it is.
And you know, you have that sort of politics, and the politics there are some of the toughest in the country. That we have a tradition called ballot bouncing, and this is where Democrats get other Democrats disqualified from running for office.
Okay.
And I did some ballot bouncing in my earlier career. You know, you do it. Here's the justification: you do it because you know your guy's better, right?
Right. That's the justification. that's the Dershowitz argument. Anything you do because you're the best is okay, because
and also,
you're the best in the country.
And also you're like, we're all Democrats, so we must be good, right? So I think that becomes some of the justification. And I think that some of the sort of you saw in Iowa was some of that East Coast rough and tumble politics enter a place that really is supposed to be more genteel. People, Iowans are the nicest people in the country.
They're pretty
and
chill.
That's why they can have caucuses.
Yes.
If you had caucuses in Pennsylvania, they'd everybody knock each other's lights out.
Oh my God. Never mind. Guns would get drawn. Well, it depends
Absolutely.
If you're in Philly or Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Different,
right. Exactly.
Different. Yeah. Greg, you sit back. What do you feel about American style aggression?
I mean, political aggression or aggression?
It seems like there's some overlap.
Starting to blend a little bit.
Starting to blend, but political aggression. Do you sort of share my ish on this, or are you more sort of whatever, that's just the game?
I mean, it does seem more aggressive in the States. I mean, the divide is definitely stronger. I mean, I'm always struck by the fact that you have Republican and Democrat judges. I mean, I've you know, worked in the social work field. I've been in many courtrooms in Canada, and never once have I known the political affiliation of a judge.
That bothers me too. Yeah.
I don't know the political affiliation of our Supreme Court. It's just a foreign idea to me. And yet that is one of the biggest issues in American politics, is who's going to put the judges in.
This was something I actually wanted to just circle back on before. I actually wrote it down and then circled it, literally circling back. Up in Canada, we do not have even close to an understanding of the role that judges play in American political life. Pretty much right now, the judicial branch of government is running the show. The Supreme Court is making more law than Congress is. And David, I wonder if you could send some, like, gives as an American, how you feel about that. And then I'll get Greg to sort of respond from the Canadian perspective, because this is something that chills me. It's not the way the system was designed to work.
So I think that people sort of from the critical legal theory mindset, scholars, legal scholars, like my wife, Heidi Matthews of Austin
Law. Shout out to Heidi!
Yeah. She would say that all law is political. And, you know,
which I agree with, but political and partisan are not the same thing.
That's yeah, absolutely. Right. So that's really interesting. In the States, it is the politics are partisan in that way. And right now, you see a country that supports the right to choose. You see a country that feels strongly about protecting, you know, the rights of immigrants, a country that cares about civil rights in many ways, despite what the politics might say.
And yeah.
However, we have a Supreme Court that is hell-bent on taking those things away, hell-bent on attacking workers' rights, et cetera, because of the way our appointments work. Democrats do a very terrible job of appointing young people. And I hate to say that, because in the United States, we have a lifetime appointment.
Right.
And you want to get a 35-year-old Doogie Howser JD out there.
I watch that show.
And you want to make sure that they get on the bench. The Republicans...
David, sorry, how many judges that Mitch McConnell has approved in the past?
Oh, God, hundreds.
How many? It's 150 or 140. Yeah.
How many are in their 40s?
They're all
in their 40s.
30s and 40s.
One more follow-up question. How many have been rated as unfit by the that organization?
Almost all.
Yeah.
So, and then you have, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I've met a few times and I think is wonderful, who wouldn't retire under Obama. And, you know, God bless her, but
that
you know,
was very, that I'm sure she's going to see as one of the biggest mistakes of her life now, because there's no guarantee Trump's going to, but what is the justification for this judicial system? Why not overhaul it and do it more like the Canadian system does, which is, you know, this kind of partisan rancor? Is it just because that's where the Republican part, that's what gets people out to vote?
Well, that's actually interesting, because I think that it wouldn't be bad to see a system more like Canada's. However, you would have to say, we got to get rid of everybody, because the fact is that we've had 40 or 50 years of highly partisan appointments. Mm-hmm. And now that started very early. You know, that started, I can't think of the first case that really called into the political questioning of, and I really should, I'm a law school graduate, I should remember this, but the first case that dealt with judicial independence and in politics, there was a question about how political the bench should be. And right. It, from that point on, it became political. And right. I think that people in the States would like to see it be less political, but also just can't stand not winning. So when you get your guy in, or your woman in, hopefully someday soon, you want to make sure that then you can go on and have the bench reflect that. So at this point, because we are in a state of war, I think that getting people to back down from that is going to be very difficult.
Now, is it just they want to win, or is it also they don't want to get tarred and feathered by their own side? Because I ask this question again on Twitch. I do a lot of my, like, you know, anecdotal research on my Twitch streams. I said during, like, watching the impeachment hearings, you're supposed to have separation of church and state. But every day, the Senate trial started with a dude praying. And I was like, how is this happening? And the Americans who answered said, it isn't separation of church and state, but it's just a third rail. Nobody wants to touch it. And in that case, it's just an erosion of separations because nobody wants to get run out of the room. So there's an element of that too, isn't there, David?
I think that's absolutely true. I think that we have a sense. I think that I think that the separation of church and state is better than it has been in the past.
Really?
I believe that. I do believe that. I think it's still bad. Okay. And I think that it still infects, you know, especially the southern states and states like Ohio, where you see things like heartbeat bills and things like that. But
I see. Oh, okay, you're coming at it from there. All right. Yeah, all right.
But
all
then
right. I see your point there.
But then you see a situation where you have, you know, largely school prayer has gone away. You have situations where, unlike in Canada, we do not have public funding of Catholic schools. And, you know, that is the separation in church and state
issue
that is a little bit different here. I think it's fine, but it is, you know, it is different. So you have those sort of things that are slightly better, and then you have the things that are slightly worse. But I think that the partisanship is the biggest issue.
Now, Greg, if they opened certain major, like, things in the House of Commons with a prayer, would you be okay with that? Or would you sort of share my opinion? It's like, what? What is going on?
No, I have a big problem with that.
Okay.
I'm not a Christian. So, you know, why are my representatives showing preference to Christianity? You know, I have a lot of love and respect for Christianity and Christians, and just like I do for Islam and Judaism and such on down the line. But again, separation of church and state is such a monumentally important aspect of a representative democracy, and one especially as multicultural as our society happens to be. The second you show any kind of preference one way or the other, that shirt starts to unravel pretty quickly, I think.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate here and ask anybody if anyone's held any money in Canada.
What do you mean, held any money?
You know, yeah, you have some cash. You looked at it, right?
What?
Who is on the money?
Oh, well, that's changing right now.
Yeah, so it's interesting. That's the head of the Church of England.
Oh, the Queen. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
but we don't think of it that way. See, our religions up here are hockey and Tim Hortons.
It's true.
Like, that's our state sponsored religion. And I know I'm kind of joking because now we've got heavy competition from the Raptors.
Yeah.
That has sort of become the United Church of Canada is Jurassic Park down in Toronto. But
I like that as a member of the United Church of Canada. I like that.
Yeah, that's, like it. But I'm pretty sure that we have some of these things that give us our national identity because, you know, let's face it, our cities are browning rapidly. And most of us are okay with that because, I mean, and this is where, again, the purpose of this podcast comes in. We don't come from a history of revolution. Right. I mean, that whole Catholic school thing was basically reconciliation with the French. Right. It goes all the way back to the founding of the country. It was an all right, we'll give you this. It's one thing that doesn't totally make sense on ethical grounds, but it was we're just all going to get along here and let you have that. But we do sort of not have that. We fought for our rights and won identity in Canada. And I think it does make us solve problems very differently. Greg, since you're the Canadian, I'll open that up to you and ask you if you know, you'd agree with that statement.
So here's an interesting kind of aspect to look at it from.
Okay.
If you look at kind of mass psychology, and maybe David knows the exact answer, but what's the stat for how many years the US has not been at war in their history? It's in the single digits, I think, isn't it?
Well, do we count the Cold War?
So actually there was, I mean, if war is complicated and I think that's, but to go back to what I think is a war is when we have troops on the ground, we're fighting things.
Right. So hot war.
My wife would disagree with me because she knows the proper definitions for these things.
Yes.
But, you know, the fact is, I think never really, I mean, it maybe the 1800s at some point, but you know, we've been essentially in some sort of conflict the entire history of the United States.
There officially is no peace treaty in Korea.
No. My grandfather fought in Korea, actually.
My stepdad was a Korea vet too. That is technically still at war. There's a ceasefire.
Yeah, armistice, right?
Yeah, there's an armistice, but there's no actual peace. So technically, you know, the U.S. has been in a constant state of war somewhere since the 50s.
And so I guess the point I'm trying to make is that what we know now about the impacts of war on the human psyche.
Right.
Is that it's quite devastating and it warps people in general, right? And not everybody becomes a shell-shocked person with PTSD, et cetera, but it does change people. Now, if you've had an entire society of people who have a great number of soldiers in their population, then it stands to reason that people would be a bit different. A bit more prone to maybe aggression or confrontation. I mean, there is the, you're talking about some of the Pashtun fighters in Afghanistan.
Yeah, the Kurds.
And the Kurds too. And they say they're a society that is very warlike and that is raised on that. And so they are tough as nails and very, very strong. And that kind of mentality permeates the society. Do you wonder if maybe there's an element of that in there? I mean, everybody's had their theories over the years about why Americans are the way Americans are and the good and the bad, but I don't know.
You know, Greg, you might be onto something there because it's not just military veterans. It's also like inner city youth. Those neighborhoods were practically war zones. Some of them are getting better, but, you know, just, you know, getting back to the idea of interactions with police and just the, you know, going to schools with metal detectors and barbed wire and all that stuff, the constant state of stress that Americans live under. And it may be particularly acute for young Americans, but maybe not anymore because of the financial crisis and how a lot of, you know, near retirees lost their savings. But going back to this idea of, you know, Trump seems to revel in stories where someone died. It's a big part of all of his speeches. But then, you know, there are Democratic candidates. Bernie Sanders is the biggest one to me that just, he has this language of calamity. And I wonder if there isn't a sort of, I don't know if it's cynical or these guys have both been just around for a long time and, you know, both of them have essentially been making the same speeches since the 80s in one way or another, but have they just found that is what makes people sit up and pay attention? So I know, David, you're probably chomping at the bit with this, but Greg, I'll open it up to you first as sort of a social work perspective.
Well, I mean, yeah, like I think politicians will always be reflective of the society that they're trying to become leaders of. And then you'll see different variations. Again, you'll see someone like Warren who's very pragmatic and has plans and tries to appeal on that level. But there is a significant portion of the American population, and I would argue the human population in general, if you look around the world at the politics of many different nations, there are a lot of people who are angry, scared, just agitated in general. I mean, our human population has doubled in a century. Like that cannot come without consequences, right? We are jammed up, resources are drying up, and people are looking around and recognizing the world is shaky. It is not a stable place. And so you have people just trying to harness that, people who want to reach the pinnacles of power, and they will glam onto that. And we are seeing that in Canadian politics. If you look at the conservative leadership race right now, it is a run to the right. I know Aaron O'Toole, talk about one specific candidate. I've known him for many years, and he has typically been a reasonable gentleman, nice guy, just to kind of middle of the line politics. In the last month, his Twitter feed is infuriating.
Well, they need to bring the money in, right?
Yeah, and it's a race to the right for them. So I just think, again, it's reflective of the population. If there's enough people who feel that way, then they will get the support. If nobody felt that way, they'd be ignored.
All right. All right, David. So we're opening up to you now. Is the Democratic candidate going to be the person, much like Trump was, who scares people the most?
I don't think there's any need to scare people. I think Trump scared people. I think that the Democrats overall have been scaring people about Trump and in addition. And I think that everybody's got a different sort of solution for that and how that works.
So it's fear and loathing by proxy, basically.
Yeah. So I think that no one has clean hands in the fear game here.
Right. And I'm not implying for a second that they do. That's what I'm asking.
I don't think you are. Yeah. I think we are at a point where I think dire occasions require dire measures. So I think that who will win in the Democratic primary is going to be who makes people feel like they can get it done against what's an existential threat to the democracy in the United States.
You really think it is going to be the electability question above all else?
Yeah, and I think the electability calculations going to change over time as we see what happens in these different states. And I think that organization is going to be important. And you know, with Biden out of the picture, and I think Biden is out of the picture, it's
going to
be a really interesting race.
Greg, do you think Biden's out of the picture?
It feels that way. It really does.
Okay, so we're all going to go. So last thing I want to touch on very briefly, non-impeachment itself, which was a freaking gong show, and we could go on forever about that, and I think everybody's just done with it. But what's the ultimate impact of impeachment? You know, other than Hakeem Jeffries basically cementing his very bright future in Democratic politics, David, I'll start with you. What did impeachment do? Was it just sort of the opening salvo for 2020, or am I missing something?
I think that the real impact of impeachment is that because I think they chose grounds that, and this could be a whole episode, and I would love for you to invite me back to talk about it, but
yeah.
I think the opening salvo is important. I think that was the political impact,
right?
Or that was the hope that they were going to have. But I think that because the U.S. is highly procedural and precedent matters, I think that Trump getting off essentially scot-free and sort of defining what, you know, Dershowitz defining what was an acceptable, you know, use of executive power in the way that they did, I think it kind of defines a presidency that is a little unwieldy and really could do a lot more damage before it ends.
Okay, as a lawyer, did that whole thing just drive you nuts?
I thought that they should have went after him on emoluments clause. I think there was 100 things you could go after him. But I think that choosing something that has it as central character, the son of one of the leading contenders for your party's election, is really dumb.
But why didn't they just go straight up for bribery? Bribery and treason.
There's a million things. I mean, honestly, like you could probably just sit here and list them all day. But, you know, I think they chose this one because they were obsessed with Russia. They couldn't pin him on Russia. So they said, as all Americans are, they're like, Ukraine, Russia, what's the difference?
Right.
And, you know,
we're all Tom Clancy fans at heart.
Yeah, right. You know, they all eat pierogies or whatever. But, you know, the thing is that the people
so do people in Saskatchewan and Alberta. Yeah. Insult the pierogies in Canada.
I'm from cold country in Pennsylvania. I've eaten more pierogies.
There you go.
And believe me, when you see me, it shows.
Sorry, so you were saying?
So, the thing is that by leaving the sort of opening, I think that you're going to see Trump go harder and harder with the executive branch against the Democrats in a political way. I'm very fearful that they took their biggest swing and it was a miss.
And they missed. Greg, what do you think?
Does anybody think he's leaving now? Honestly, honestly think he's leaving that office willingly?
Oh, you think he will not go if he loses, when he loses?
I didn't see it before.
Huh.
But now, I mean, what's the incentive, right? Like, what he's awaiting charges when he's done the presidency. The SDNY has filed charges waiting for the second he walks out that door. He's in the same exact spot that Bibi Netanyahu's in Israel.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't even know if it's cynicism anymore to sit there and go, I don't think he's going. I mean, he just broke the law. Quite frankly, the budget office or
the accountability office, sorry, came out fully and said that the actions with Ukraine broke the law, period, full
right.
stop.
Right.
So he breaks the law. He thumbs his nose. He does everything that Nixon did that made Nixon lose his job and have to resign.
Right.
And there was zero consequence. If anything, they gave him a pat on the back. It's a great job, pal. So, I mean, you're setting a person who's falling apart and extremely narcissistic, and you're just setting them loose. And again, they're going to continue to float them up there so they can accomplish their agenda and tear apart the administrative state of the United States. That was Steve Bannon's goal, as he said it in the beginning.
Right.
So, I mean, the people who want this to stay as is hold all the cards at this point. And the only thing that I feel like U.S. citizens could possibly do to affect this is a general strike. And I don't think they have it in them.
Wow. That's almost an Amazon Prime show right there.
It's not.
I guess the closest is the student climate strikes.
Yeah. And even those had not very much impact on anything. Let's be frank. It'll get Greta the Nobel Peace Prize, but that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, we can do a whole show on the ineffectiveness of modern protest movements because they don't understand how to protest. But I think this might be a good place to stop, unless either of you gentlemen have some final words on stuff you're chomping at the bit to cover.
I just want to say one last thing. I want to thank all the druids and mages out there,
yeah,
the rogues and all the people who've sat around a table and thrown some dice.
We can't leave out Rangers.
Us play with you tonight, and
we can't leave out Rangers. What other classes have we missed? Paladins. We can't leave out Paladins. I mean, they won't complain. Yeah. They're Paladins. monks. Yeah, we better be careful with monks. They tend to get quite violent. But and any other D&D class or 3.5 edition hybrid class, because that could be absolutely anything. I think that's when I switched over to being a thief, by the way, is third ed. Because of those high level thief skills.
We're lefties, we're big tent people. Everyone's welcome, right?
And if I could just do a quick plug, I just want to give a plug for the podcast I do with my wife, Heidi Matthews.
Yes, because we love Heidi.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can find that on SoundCloud. And I just want to plug my Twitter quickly, at @DAVIDSLAVICK. Have a great day.
Greg, you want to plug anything?
No, just vote. Be good.
All right. This has been the America's Hat Podcast, the inaugural America's Hat Podcast. Don't know how often we're going to be doing these. There'll be a series of specials until further notice. But this has been the FU Network. If you want to support us, we are not funded by any major political party. So your Patreon support is greatly appreciated. Your merchandise support, buy a t-shirt, buy some socks, buy I don't know what we got up there, but funetwork.tv. And don't worry that we're America's Hat, because Canadians are just too polite to look down on anyone. I have been Leanna Kersner. David, Greg, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is fun! The FU Network!